Court will proceed to the third case of the day, United States v. Fiasci. Mr. Ackerman.
Please, the Court, good morning. Gentlemen of the prosecution, co-counsel.
I'm Alan Ackerman. I have the privilege of representing Mr. Fiasci. Good morning, Mr. Evans. Judge Evans.
Good morning.
Judge Woods.
Mr. Ackerman.
I'm well-dressed. And
always.
I'm prepared. Although I had to go to the dentist, I'll do my best. I realize that the
hopefully
court...
Hopefully this isn't as painful as going to the dentist.
Well, that would depend on what follows now. I know it's discouraged, but I'm compelled to ask permission to read one sentence from Florida versus Bostwick, Bostick, where Justice O'Connor for the majority states as follows. This court, as the dissent correctly observes, is not empowered to suspend constitutional guarantees so that the government may more effectively wage a war on drugs, period. If that war is to be fought, those who fight it must respect the rights of individuals, whether or not those individuals are suspected of having committed a crime. The case at hand is a stark example of zealous agents, and these agents, incidentally, this is not the world anymore that Justice Cardozo spoke of where the constable blunders. These are well-trained, college-educated, seminar-exposed agents and task force officers who well know that they have the opportunity for telephone warrants, email warrants, consulting with the AUSA on duty in order to invade private premises. In this particular case, that part of the record which is pristine reflects as follows. A week in advance of September 2, 2005, a gentleman was seized in Kentucky, and he had a little bit of marijuana in his vehicle. He opted to talk to the constables, and he told them that, hey, on September 2 or September 3, a fellow named Tony, who lives in a nice house in Chicago, and he describes the area, and whose phone numbers are blank, he and somebody else are going to take $500,000 out east, presumptively to pay for drugs or buy more drugs. And that's the basis of the information that the DEA agents have when they decide at about 11:30 in the morning on Friday, September 2, 2005, to go to the premises that they have identified as Mr. Fiasci's home. What do they see? From about 11:45 or thereabouts, they see Mr. Fiasci get into a black Lexus, drive to a chiropractor, leave the chiropractor and drive to Gottlieb Memorial Hospital where he's treated for asthma, and return. Nothing else. In the interim, or about the same time, they see Mr. Vitigliano drive up in a Chevy Malibu, park in Mr. Fiasci's driveway, go in with a keypad entry, leave 20 minutes later carrying a box and a bag. Keep in mind that the essence of the information, albeit a week old, is that they're going to ferry $500,000 in USC out east. Nothing about dealing dope from that house. This is the essence of it. So being the vigilant officers they are, they follow Mr. Vitagliano and they stop him. And I'm not going to get into co-counsel's argument. He's a very persuasive advocate, and I'm sure he will speak on Mr. Vitt's behalf. But all that said, a half hour goes by, and now you have five or six or seven agents, and really the number is relatively unimportant, caucusing, and they decide not to get a telephone warrant, not to seek an email warrant, not to contact an AUSA, but they're going to knock and talk, and they hope to get consent. to enter and search. And with this ruse, a number of them go to the front door, and mysteriously Agent Oko goes to the side of the building. Now, this is a fenced-in area, a stone fence. Nobody can see over it. There's a gate. And so the government fairly concedes in the district court that this was curtilage.
I'm not sure they do that, actually. I
mean, well, the district
you're calling it curtilage. They're calling it the backyard. We all know that there's a difference between backyards and curtilage. You're not challenging knock and talks, per se, I assume.
There's
a lot of water under the bridge on those.
Not so fast.
I am going to go this fast because time is short.
And I apologize. I didn't mean it that way.
What I think we need to recognize is that insofar as your client's concerned, first of all, there's some evidence that they're in the meantime collecting from Mr. Vitagliano. But on the other hand, as they approach with a knock and talk, they start to hear things. Agent Oko hears some things. He eventually hears some flushing. And by that time, the government says there are exigent circumstances. I would think, had they called for your telephone warrant while they're all standing around outside at about, let's say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, before they decide to do the consent search, I don't know what they would have presented as probable cause for the warrant. I think the probable cause, the exigent circumstances, arise with the flushing and the running.
I will, with your permission, I won't advert to the running because the recent decisions from this court, including United States versus Ellis, cited in the brief, and the more recent case, United States versus Collins and McNeil, tend to suggest that that's what you can expect when you knock on the door. Running.
It's all contextual, as you will agree.
I attack this because the government has not said one word in their answering brief regarding curtilage. And the curtilage here is what's prominent. And it's not called backyard, it's curtilage. And that is, the government may not breach that threshold absent a warrant. And it's presumptively unreasonable unless there is both probable cause and emergency. And in McNeil, we substitute exigent circumstances for emergency. So now, we have this agent at the side, cannot see, but he claims to hear a swishing sound. Now, we're not talking about Captain Marvel or Superman. A swishing sound. I can't otherwise describe it. Well, my goodness, is that a reason to breach the home? Because effectively, that's what they did. Because everything that followed from that swish, I heard a swish. I ran to see what. Yes, I opened the gate and ran in. From that point on, he shouldn't have been there. Ergo, the flushing should not have been heard. And the flushing, by the way, is as innocent as it can be because people flush their toilets all the time in the morning and early afternoon.
Mr. Ackerman, are you questioning whether Mr. Oko could be on the side of the house?
He was on the side of the house.
Questioning that he had a right to be there, excuse me.
That part of the house, that's on the sidewalk, and that's public.
Right, so his vantage point, it was in no way invading any curtilage issue.
His vantage point was not, however, as it's clear from the briefs, he hears a mystic sound and runs in. And that's what he did, and he might just as well have run in the house as run into the back area that's all fenced in. My time has expired, I regret to say, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ackerman. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the Court, Counsel Andrew J. McGowan for the defendant Antonio Vitagliano. Mr. Vitagliano appeals the district court's denial of his motion to suppress as well. I'd like to focus on the reason the government believes there's reasonable suspicion in this case. And it begins with what they saw. And that's, in fact, all they know about Mr. Vitagliano, what they saw. The informant did not mention anything about Mr. Vitagliano. In fact, the only thing that he did mention about another person was another male, and that they might be leaving in a rental car. Mr. Pitagliano was not driving a rental car. All they saw was that he got into the house and left about 15 minutes after Mr. Fiasci arrived from his little trip, carrying a paper bag and a small box. Based on that information, the agents at the time thought they had reasonable suspicion to stop him. The government repeats that argument here to some extent. However, they do focus on what the government likes to call a chase. Now, the police reports in this case do not mention anything about traffic problems. They don't mention that he was fleeing. They don't mention anything. And I think that's consistent.
But isn't there testimony, though, that the district court credited at the suppression hearing that, I mean, chase could mean a lot of things. I don't think anyone thought people were zooming down Irving Park Road at 90 miles an hour. But the district court, I thought, credits the testimony of the officers that Mr. Vitagliano is trying to evade them.
I don't read the district court's ruling that strongly. I think the district court...
He says, at that point, according to Subkowiak, Vitagliano began driving at excessive speeds and began weaving in and out of traffic in an attempt to elude surveillance. And a little bit later, I recall that he says he thinks it's Subkowiak who's telling the truth.
I believe, and what Your Honor just read, I think is a couching. He says that Subkowiak says that, and then I think he says later on in the opinion that to the extent that there's a difference between what he and Vitagliano said, he credits them more. And I think he characterizes throughout the opinion what happened on them as erratic driving, and I think that's exactly what happened. And I don't think that the testimony actually contradicts the reports. As I was saying, the reports reflect that when they sat down to write this, all the agents who wrote reports, and three of them were involved in this pursuit, if that's what the government wants to call it, but it's just a traveling down a road, they didn't write down anything about traffic problems, and I think that's consistent with what happened. It was a busy afternoon. Traffic on that road, any kind of busy road in Chicago, ordinarily is difficult. You got people cutting out in front of you, just as agents of Kowiak described.
Well, and the court does actually rather specifically say this court finds Subkowiak's testimony more credible than Vitagliano's regarding the driving style. So
right.
I guess that's, is it erratic or...
And the court also refers to this as erratic driving. And I don't doubt that there was some erratic driving, and I don't doubt that Subkowiak had trouble keeping up with Mr. Vitagliano under these circumstances, but I certainly don't think that it establishes that there was fleeing, that... Subkowiak also believed that he was on the phone with Fiasci. He believed that he identified, Vitagliano identified him. I don't think any of that can be established in the record under the evidence. It's his imagination.
Also, it seems it's fairly important that when they were staked out at the house, he stops for a few minutes, comes out carrying a box like it's a cake, puts it in the car.
You know, if they had any information about what was in the house, that might carry some weight. But at this point, they don't know what's in the house. In fact, the informant tells them about the outside of the house, but not the inside, which suggests that, assuming that he transferred money to him, it wasn't inside the house. We don't know what's in the house. And that's why I think this case is very similar to the Johnson case that this court decided. We don't know what's in the house, but we do know a lot about what's on the outside of the house. And, I mean, the similarities are actually kind of striking. And Johnson, we had the landlord informing on the person. The police conferred with the caretaker of the apartment. Everybody knows who's in the house. They probably know their phone number. So, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the information. It's all corroborated. But in that case, this court said that somebody walking out of the house couldn't be seized. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And the distinction between the only difference, factually, that I can see legally significant, is that Vitagliano's carrying these packages. But these packages themselves don't indicate what's in them. We don't know what's in the house. And therefore, I don't think that they changed the equation here.
Mr. McGowan, I didn't see anything, but maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, in this record indicating the police tried to justify the stop of Mr. Vitagliano's vehicle for a traffic violation. Did they justify it that way?
They did not.
They did not. I didn't.
And the government has not pursued that even here. And they use this information to establish that Mr. Vitagliano is trying to flee. But as I said, I just don't think that the evidence establishes that. I don't doubt that Office of Kaliak may have had those concerns, but since they're not based on any evidence, they are just that, concerns. I don't think they even rise to the level of a hunch under these facts. Unless there are any other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Mr. Deese?
May it please the Court. My name is Greg Dice, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I'd like to address the two primary issues in this appeal in reverse order. I'd start with Pitagliano. The primary issue in Pitagliano's appeal is whether the district court's Terry stop of his car was supported by reasonable suspicion. The government submits that it was for three primary reasons. First, the DEA agents received information from a cooperator that two males, one named Tony, were trafficking drugs out of a house in the proximity of Lawrence and Maria in Chicago. Based on additional investigation, officers were able to pinpoint that address as 4738 North Maria. Second, the officers then set up surveillance at the house and observed Pitagliano enter 4738 North Maria by entering a security code and a keypad and leave 30 minutes later carrying two packages.
But the question, I suppose, prior question is, what did the Kentucky State Police happen to know about Mr. Bjerga's reliability? I mean, I could go describe a house at any intersection in Chicago and say, I think there's drug trafficking going on at this house at, you know, 55th and Woodlawn down in Hyde Park or so. Even if I didn't know, I could probably give you a perfect exterior description of the house. And I could probably figure out on the Internet, if I had a little bit of skill, who lives there.
To answer your question, Judge Wood, the record doesn't reflect any corroboration done by the DEA task force officers in Kentucky. The corroboration in the record relates to the corroboration done by the DEA officers here. I touched on two points, but let me touch on the two that I think are key. One is the corroboration of the two phone numbers. One, of course, does come back to defendant Antonio Fiasci, consistent with the name Tony, and the address is the same as the one that they had pinpointed earlier. But in addition, the second phone is an unpaid prepaid phone without subscriber information, which is precisely the type of phone drug dealers use. That is not an innocent detail that was corroborated.
But not only drug dealers use those phones. All sorts of people with bad credit and the like might want those prepaid phones.
That's certainly correct, Your Honor. And although you're correct, there could be innocent explanations as to why someone has a prepaid phone without subscriber information. In these circumstances, the district court was entitled to defer to the experience and of the officers involved here. So the fact that there could be innocent explanations doesn't rule out the possibility of them relying on the prepaid phone as corroboration and evidence that drug dealing was going on
very,
in the house.
Very thin. I mean, the fact that the name comes up consistent with Tony is one thing. I think the prepaid and anonymous phone is awfully weak.
The other point I would note, Your Honor, is the information that the cooperator was providing. It was a little bit more than just a little bit of dope. It was 10 pounds of marijuana. But that's all the officers in Kentucky knew. In telling the officers that he had dropped off $135,000 to this individual, Tony, in Chicago, he was implicating himself to a greater extent. So the information that he was providing was inculpatory. And in light of that, that also supports the district court's finding with respect to the reliability of the cooperator. Mr. Pitagliano contends that the district court didn't make findings with respect to evasive driving, and I think, Judge Wood, you pointed precisely to the portion of the opinion where the court makes those findings. I would just point the court again to 827. It's actually at two places. The court most certainly did make findings, and they made them at two places. The first is 827, which I think is the testimony, Judge Wood, that you quoted. And then the second point is at 830. And it's significant here because 830, the title of the page is analysis. So the suggestion that there were factual findings, but they somehow didn't factor into the district court's decision is undermined by just by looking at the page itself. But if you look at what the court states at 8:30, quote, while it is true that the agents did not note that Pataglano was driving erratically or on his cell phone in a criminal report, there was sufficient credible testimony on those matters at the suppression hearing, close quote. So the court factored in the fact that the information wasn't in the reports. And by the way, the reports aren't in the record. The only information related to what was in the reports came through witness testimony, but it is clear from the record that some of this information was not contained in reports. Appellants essentially asked this court to sweep these findings to the side, apparently requiring some sort of explicit language on the part of the district court that I'm making these factual findings and I'm making these factual findings for the express purpose of the conclusions I'm reaching in this case. But that's not how we read district court opinions. Respectfully, appellants seek to parse the district court's opinion far too finely. It's clear, based on a fair reading of the district court's opinion, that it made factual findings, both with respect to Pataglano's driving style and with an issue not really touched on, but it is an issue that bears on the extreme circumstances here, the fact that Pataglano was on a cell phone.
Yeah, that evidence is a little strange, isn't it? Because they think they see him using a Razor phone. That phone doesn't check out as having been used, you know, unless he just likes to drive around making people think he's on the phone or something. I found those dots not connected very well.
Your Honor, you're correct that Sipkowiak's testimony is that he saw him on a Razor phone, and the records for the Razor phone reflect that no call was made. But the district court certainly did not commit clear error here in finding that Sipkowiak and crediting Sipkowiak's testimony that he saw him on the phone. Initially, I'd point out, Pataglano himself testified that he was on the phone. And that is at the suppression record, page 263. In addition, you have Sipkowiak's testimony that he saw him on the phone. Healy also testified that around 150 or 155, he was radioed by Sipkowiak, and Sipkowiak told him, yes, I've got him in my sights, and I saw him on the telephone. And then you have the phone records from the other phone. There were two phones in the car. One was the Razor phone that Your Honor mentioned. The other one was not a Razor phone, but it reflects a call that was made at 150. So there's certainly...
Just a minute-long call, right?
That's according to the records, it does reflect that it was a minute-long. Another on the same point, Your Honor, at page 20 of their reply brief, the appellants try and create some sort of tension between Sipkowiak's testimony and the fact that the cell phone records reflect the call was at 150. If you look at page 20 of the reply brief, they suggest that Sipkowiak testified that he saw Pataglano on the phone at around 2 o'clock. In support of this proposition, appellants cite Sipkowiak's testimony at pages 22 and then 47 through 48. But if you look at those pages, 22, pages 47 to 48, Sipkowiak testified that his surveillance of Pataglano started at approximately 150, but he does not state that he saw Pataglano on the phone 10 minutes later, as appellant suggests. You can look at those pages. That there's nothing in the testimony to support that. In fact, if you look at page 50 of Agent Sipkowiak's testimony, he testified that he saw Pataglano on the phone, quote, a few minutes after 150. And again, that's the suppression transcript at page 50. And that testimony is consistent with the information in the phone records. Again, there is sufficient evidence, there's abundant evidence indeed, supporting the district court's factual finding that Pataglano was on his cell phone.
So maybe just to cut to the chase, in terms of Pataglano, is it the government's argument that if you can justify that first stop as a Terry stop, everything else for Pataglano kind of falls in place thereafter? They're allowed to frisk him. He says it's X that he's got in the bag and all the rest of it.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Maybe you should say a word about Mr. Fiasci.
Yeah, so in terms of the Fiasci's motion to suppress, which relates to the protective sweep that occurred at 4738 North Murray, the primary issue is whether there was probable cause and exigent circumstances that supported the DEA's entry into the house. As the government demonstrated in its response brief, the record in this case firmly supports the district court's conclusion on both fronts. Let me start with probable cause. First, the DEA agents had information supplied by the cooperating informant relating to drug activity in the house. In addition to the corroboration I just discussed, the Pataglano traffic stop itself corroborated the information that the cooperator had provided. The second point is that the DEA officers found 250 ecstasy pills in the packages that Pataglano had just taken out of the house at 4738 North Maria less than a half an hour ago. So at this point, as the district court found, there was clear It was clearly reasonable for the agents to believe that both drugs and drug money were passing through 4738 North Maria. Firm probable cause. In terms of the exigent circumstances, three primary factors support the district court's conclusion. First, the DEA officers had observed Vitagliano on a cell phone while under surveillance, which heightened concerns and focused that he may have alerted Fiasci to the police surveillance outside the house. Second, when DEA officers arrived at the door, knocked at the door, Fiasci yelled, "Hold on," and then officers observed him running from the door. Finally, and of course this is the most important point, Agent Oco heard a flushing noise right around the same time that the officers at the door knocked.
And then Mr. Ackerman says he had no business being in the backyard, though, at that point, because he had essentially was inside the house in the curtilage. No, but seriously, the curtilage is that area of the home up next to the house that retains Fourth Amendment protection.
Correct, Your Honor. The district court concluded that Oco was justified in being in the backyard based primarily on its crediting his testimony. Agent Oco testified that he heard a swishing noise,
sees the screens broken, right?
Right. Correct, Your Honor. So he hears a swishing noise. And to put Oco's testimony in context, he was aware that agents were at the door making contact. In fact, the express reason, the precise reason that he was standing on the side of the house was to protect against the possibility that somebody might run outside of the house.
Were they in communication?
Yes, they were, Your Honor. There were three to four agents at the door, and then there was an agent, Fernandez, who was, for lack of a better term, a go-between.
Yeah, I want to know whether Oco is on the side, and is he communicating electronically with the record reflect, is he with the agents in front?
Your Honor, I don't think the record...
We have some agents in front and Oco on the side. Is that right? About three agents in the front?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they're able to see through what kind of a door? What does the record reflect about this running away from the knock?
It's some sort... I think it's a stained glass, so it's... officer...
The record says, yes, they see an image of someone coming to the door and then leaving, is that it?
They saw two things. They actually saw the blinds move. So they knock, they see someone approach, the blinds move, they see somebody open the blinds, and then they hear someone yell, "Hold on," and then they see Fiasci running from...
Does Oco know about any of this that's going on in the front? The record reflect whether Oco is just positioned there originally? And is he in any way in communication with those agents in the front?
He is, Your Honor, and again, not by way of radio as you the question you asked, but there's Agent Fernandez who is going back and forth between Agent Oco and the agents at the door. And
so Fernandez goes to the side and says to Oco, "They've run away," or "Someone has run away from the front." Is that what the record?
Actually, what Agent Fernandez testified is she saw Oco go into the backyard. Because he was alone, she went to follow him to make sure that he had the support he needed. And at that point, she knew that they had somebody at the front door. So Oco tells her, "I just heard a flush. Go back and tell the people at the front door." She tells Oco that we've got somebody at the front door, I think was the substance of her testimony. And Oco at that point says, "Go get the people at the front door. Tell them I hear a flush." And by the time they get back, there had actually been a second flush. It was less than a minute later. So in terms of the course...
They leave the front unguarded, is that it?
No, Your Honor. Two agents remained at the front door. Agent Arthur, I'm sure, and actually the record isn't 100% clear on who the other agent was, but the remainder of the agents, Fernandez, Troud, and some of the others, go then to the back door with Oco, and that's actually where they enter the house, that screen door we hid. Seen the screen torn, and it's close to the window from which they heard the flushing of the toilets.
This screen door, where is that located? That Oco believes someone went through and ran out of the house. Where is that? Is that on the side where Oco is, or is that in the backyard? Where is that?
It's in the backyard, Your Honor.
So Oco's on the side, he hears swishing, and then he hears, what does the record reflect about his perception of someone going out, running out in the back?
Your Honor, Oco testified, Fiasci contends so the district court correctly credited Oco's testimony, and Oco's testimony was that he heard the swishing noise. In addition to the swishing noise, Oco was also aware at the time he heard the swishing noise that the officers at the door were were making contact with the occupants, heightening the likelihood of somebody trying to leave the house. And Oka was also aware of the fact that drugs were found in the Battagliato car. So at the point that he heard the swishing noise, that's the state of the record in terms of his knowledge. Does that answer your question, Judge Blum?
Yeah, I'm aware of what Oka apparently knew from the stop. I'm just trying to understand Oka on the side of the house, mm-hmm. assuming that's appropriate for him to be there for the reasons the government represents. And I'm trying to focus on what causes him, to, in addition to the swishing sound, to believe he should go in the back and with, I guess, Agent Fernandez.
Based on the swishing noise, he perceived that as somebody trying to run out the door. That was his testimony. And I think to add context to that testimony, it's important to note that the officers at the door were making contact.
The record reflect whether, is this Fernandez who's the communicator, comes from the front to the side with Oka?
Yes, Your Honor.
How contemporaneous is this knowledge that someone left the front door when knocked and the swishing sound? I mean, I'm trying to see what possibly Oka can have by way of information when he makes his decision to make the entry into the backyard. Fernandez come around and say somebody, we knocked and they left the door.
No, Your Honor. Actually, Agent Oka testified that he did not hear the knock, and there was no communication between Fernandez and Agent Oka until after he was in. Well, I don't know whether there was communication, but the record doesn't speak to communication between the two until Fernandez comes to provide backup while he's in the backyard, and they communicate. He says,
just off a swishing sound, not aware of anything that's transpiring in the front door?
Let me be clear. He does know that the people are at the front door and they are about to knock. I mean, he...
Okay, I understand that.
Okay.
I assume that's part of the plan. Somebody's going to knock and he's going to go to the side.
Precisely, Your Honor.
So he's standing at the side. And here's what transpires once he arrives there, according to the record. He just hears a swishing sound and that triggers his doing something?
Yes, he testified that he did not hear the knock, but he did know that he heard the swish. What he testified to was he heard the swishing sound right around the same time that the agents at the door were knocking. So
how could he possibly know that? Is it because it's so close to the front?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's essentially like this gentleman here and I'm here.
But he couldn't hear the knock, but he knows they're about to knock.
Correct. They may have knocked, they may not have knocked. The record doesn't speak to that question, but he certainly knew that they were about ready to knock. And again, that was precisely the reason he was on the side of the house. I see that my time is up. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Mr. Acton, your time expired, but you had some questions, so you may have a minute.
I will take a minute. I will make an unusual appellate motion. There are photographs in the record. The district court rejected my motion to supplement the record on appeal. The district court clerk included that motion and photographs of exactly what we're talking about, so I would verbally move to supplement the record on appeal so the court has the benefit of looking at the actual photographs and reports. As far as Agent Oka on the side, the transcript is abundantly clear. He is by himself. The front is where these fine ladies and gentlemen are, and he is all the way on the side around a corner so the people at the front cannot see him, and he hears this mystical swish, and he doesn't know anything about a screen door. That is not realized until he invades the backyard. Thank you.
Mr. McGowan? And before that, you may start. And I'm just going to give some time to the government to respond to your motion. Government may have 7 days, Mr. Dice, to respond to this motion to supplement the record.
To the extent that the government's relying on my client's testimony about whether he was on the phone when he was leaving the house, my client testified that he made a call for about a minute, not even that much, I don't think, right when he left the house. So to the extent that this... following my client went on for 10 minutes or so, he was not on the phone. The record is very clear on that point. I also want to point out that when Sipkowiak testified about my client's erratic driving, specifically about speeding, what he said was that he had to go that fast to catch up to my client, He was not pacing him. He did not have a radar gun. All he said was because of the traffic problems that were abundantly clear throughout the rest of everybody's testimony, he was having trouble keeping up with Mr. Tagliano. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will proceed.